Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The history of women has existed as long as humans have, but it was not until the last half of the 20th century that women's history received recognized academic attention. Professor Gerda Lerner is a pioneer in the study of women's history and a founder of the movement to study and record the history of women. Professor Lerner's academic work has, from the outset, been characterized by the attention she drew to the differences among women in class, race, and sexual orientation. Dr. Gerda Lerner grew up in Vienna, Austria, and suffered in the Nazi persecution of the European Jews. She came to the United States as a teenager, married a writer who was subsequently blacklisted in the 1950s, and later entered Columbia University in 1958, originally to take a few classes, and by 1966, she had earned a doctorate in history. In her recent book, Fireweed, a Political Autobiography, she tells the story of her life up to the time she enrolled at Columbia University. When I spoke with Dr. Lerner from her home in Wisconsin, she began by describing why the distinctions among women of class, race, and sexual orientation are important.
First of all, when we are speaking about women and their history, I think we have to understand we're speaking about the majority of humankind. We're not speaking about a small minority group that can be easily identified by one or another characteristic. And I think this has been one of the important discoveries that people that have tried to resurrect the history of women have had to deal with. We cannot make generalizations about women any more than we can make valid generalizations about men as a group. They're too large and too varied. So what we have come to see is that whatever we study and whatever we say about women has to be qualified or distinguished by paying attention to the location of the women, who they are, which particular subgroup they might fit into.
In describing those subgroups, are there some particular key points or classifications that you found to be important?
Well, race in America is a very important divider, you know, and color. I mean, race is an invalid term, but it's used as a metaphor for distinguishing people of color from so-called white people. And class, the economic location, the kind of work you do, you know, the kind of economic resources you have access to, the kind of educational resources a woman has access to. Religion is an important marker. There are many different markers. One of the achievements of women's history has been to call attention also to differences based on sexual orientation. Those have, in the past, have been totally overlooked. We just assumed everybody was alike under the rubric women, and that isn't so. All right. So this is one of the refinements that the field has made as it has grown.
In terms of Fireweed, your political autobiography, what motivated you to write it?
Well, a number of things. I wanted to really look back on my life. I'm now in my, ninth decade. I'm over 80 years old. So you look back on your life and you try to see what does it add up to. I also felt that I had a very interesting life, in a good sense and in a bad sense. I mean, spare me from interesting lives.
It's like the Chinese say, right. May you live in an interesting time.
Yeah, I lived in an interesting time, you could say, in a number of interesting times. And I felt that that life experience shaped a lot of my thinking. And since I have been very successful in my career as a historian, people think of me as only the person, you know, that had all these successes and published one book after another and no problems, you know, when in fact it was all based on a long life of almost 50 years of attempts and failures and wrong directions and choices that led into dead ends and so forth. So I felt that that was a very important thing to share with the people who honor me and admire my work. I wanted to...
Could you share with us some of your experiences before you moved into the world of academics?
I grew up in Vienna, and I grew up in a sheltered middle-class environment with all the benefits thereof. And from one day to the next, I was defined by the new government as belonging to a group that was worse than vermin. We weren't even human, and we had no rights, and we had no recourse, and we had nobody to appeal to when we were abused. And that was a very shattering experience, apart from the actual experience of the persecution, but the concept that you could do this to human beings, you know, which of course is true all over the world, and it's true in every place, but we never know it until it happens to us or until it touches us directly. And it touched me directly very early in life. So I write about that, and I describe my experience in a Nazi jail as a hostage for my father, and the experience of being stateless and having no country that would accept me until I came to the United States. So all these things really had a great impact on me.
For some people who suffered under the Nazi regime, there was emotional defeat. For you, it seems like it was a foundational framework for your successes later in life.
Well, of course, you have to look at it that way, that I didn't know that at the time. I mean, from where I was sitting in 1939, didn't look like there were going to be great successes ahead. That's something that I had to, you know, fight through and earn. And I should say that, yes, I was a... I mean, part of what I'm describing in the book is an attitude of being a resistor, of resisting conformity, of resisting pessimism, right? And I try to describe how that happened.
Can you describe how that happened for us now?
I described that I had a family situation in which I early learned to resist authority and to mistrust it. Okay? I never felt comfortable with people telling me in an authoritative way what I was supposed to do, to think, and to act. And I think that carried over into the political.
Do you think that resistance against authority was unique to you or unique to the time and the culture from where you came?
No, certainly not unique to the culture and the time. As you said, many people went through that experience and became totally defeated by it. Other people went through the experience and became very conservative. All right? No, I think that was unique to me. And that's part of what I explore in the book with as much detail as I can. And then I describe my... you know, my struggle in America to, first of all, to become an American, to become an American writer, which was a great goal I had. I never, you know, I thought my main goal as a young woman was to become a writer, and to write in English. So learning to speak a second language well enough to be a writer in it, that was a long struggle. And I spend a lot of time in this book describing my growth as a writer and my various, that was a difficult struggle because I wasn't successful. I was intermittently successful and then not for many years, and I had to really work hard on that. And
what was the change that brought about your success? Is there
That's only as a writer, only after I became an academic. See, that was the thing. I mean, before that, I had some work published.
Well, you had a series of novels
yeah.
that characterized social situations that
right.
you had observed, integration in neighborhoods in New York.
Right. And, well, I wrote one novel about the coming of fascism, which I struggled for 12 years to write in English, and then I couldn't place it in America. They told me then it was 12 years after the end of World War II and fascism was no longer of interest to the publishers. And then the book was translated and appeared in Vienna in Austria and was very successful there. And then later I helped to organize a publishing venture for, sort of a cooperative for writers publishing their own work. And it was published in America, and it was quite well received. And then I wrote a novel about housing integration, and I was told that that was a subject of no interest when I presented it to publishers 2 years before the start of the civil rights movement. So my timing was never very good.
You were ahead of the curve.
I was either behind the curve or ahead of the curve, but never quite in the middle of it. But then when I started as an academic, when I started publishing, everything I wrote was immediately accepted and widely distributed and very successful. So I can't explain why that is. So maybe I learned to write better, or maybe the credentials helped.
Well, I'd like to ask you about your political activities before you became an academic. But first, I'd like to tell our listeners that this week we're talking with Dr. Gerda Lerner about her recent book called Fireweed, a Political Autobiography. Dr. Lerner is a retired professor from the University of Wisconsin and one of the pioneers in the creation of the academic genre of women's history. Dr. Lerner, can you tell us about the political experiences that you had before you became an academic?
Well, I went through the coming of fascism in Austria, and as a young student, I was marginally active in the anti-fascist student movements, which meant that I took considerable risk. Even being marginally involved, you risked a year or two in jail. So that kind of radicalized me. And then when I came to the United States, I fell in with a group of left-wing people. My husband, and lifelong partner, Carl Lerner, was a communist when I met him, and his friends were all people who had sort of joined the left-wing radicalism during the Depression and were very active in the theater and in the film world. And so through them, I got into that circle. And when we moved to Hollywood just prior to the outbreak of World War II, and in that period then, during the war, my husband entered the film business, and we were very involved in the unionization struggles in the film business. And in the course of this, I also joined the Communist Party and was active in neighborhood work and childcare work and in work.
What sort of things were they? Were they?
Well, in the war, it was mostly to help the war effort to promote collaboration in the post-war world with to make sure that fascism was defeated and not just Germany. And then I got involved in a women's organization after World War II called the Congress of American Women, and that was a really wonderful organization, quite large at the time, but it was attacked by the government in the Cold War period because it was affiliated with an international women's movement. And that was a post-war women's movement in which 48 women from 48 countries joined together, and their interest was in maintenance of peace and no use of atomic weapons. Okay, that of course that put us into opposition with the policy of the U.S. government, and then not racial integration. It was an American thing, but respect for people of different cultures and races, and very strong emphasis on child care, education, and health protection for children. And this American affiliate was a very active organization in which, for 4 years, black and white women organized by the tens of thousands. What characterized the organization was that it had a great interest in women's history and celebrated various events of the past, and that appealed to me a lot. So my interest in women's history was way ahead. Again, my timing was different, was ahead of the curve of everybody getting an interest in that in the late 60s. This organization was destroyed, essentially, by the Attorney General certifying it as a subversive organization and demanding that all its board members register as foreign agents, which they, of course, refused to do, since they weren't foreign agents of anybody.
Can you explain the authority that the United States Attorney General had at that time to identify subversive organizations?
Yeah, it was the McCarran Act, and all of it was declared unconstitutional about 20 years later. But by that time, the damage had been done. Listed about 60 or 70 organizations, some of them just totally innocuous organizations that had no political aim, some of them organizations that were working for racial integration. And when an organization was listed, it was virtually destroyed because the penalties were very high and people were faced with the choice of declaring themselves to be agents of a foreign government when they never even had any contact with anybody in the foreign government. I mean, it was a very, very dangerous precedent, and it's interesting that it was declared unconstitutional. But as you know, it takes 20, 30 years to work its way through the courts. And of course, the whole aim of this was to create conformity with the government's position in the Cold War.
Let's put this in the time frame when the McCarran Act was adopted by the United States Congress and signed into law by President Truman. That was in the late 40s?
Yeah. Early 50s. This is a dangerous precedent, which we did. We did the same thing. The government did the same thing at the end of World War One with the so-called Palmer raids, when thousands of immigrants were deported without due process and railroaded into jails and everything else. And I think I see a dangerous parallel emerging today, too, that worries me a lot. In other words, when we decide that a group of people is declared to be deviant and our enemy, and we do that without due process and without allowing these people to state their side of the story fairly, then we are undermining democracy in a very, very dangerous way. And I think I wanted to tell that part of the story, too, because I don't think people are too much aware of it.
Let me ask you about your attitudes towards your children's adopting their own political ideas as they were growing up.
I think that raising children in this period of the Cold War was very difficult if you really believed in free speech. I don't know about yourself. You were probably too young, but my children grew up at the time in New York City in the public schools. And they were told by their teachers and by their government that if a nuclear bomb fell on New York City, that if they ducked under their desk and hid their head with their hands, they would be perfectly safe. Now, you know, a greater lie cannot be spoken than that. It was totally false. And nothing would protect those children if a bomb fell on New York City. And we were forced, we were told that our children were supposed to have dog tags on day and night in case of a nuclear attack so you could identify them. Well, as parents and as people who work for peace and people who work for nuclear disarmament, we could not go along with that. And so it forced us to go to the school and say, My daughter is not going to wear that. And it forced her to become different from the other children, right? Which I regretted, but it was a question of principle. You know, in the horrible, unimaginable event of a nuclear war, there would be nobody to collect those dog tags, nor would there be parents to whom to send them, right? I mean, we know that. So it was this kind of thing. There was a constant pressure for conformity. And on the other hand, we never tried to indoctrinate our children in our ideas. We exposed them, of course, to contacts with people of color and people from other countries and other cultures that we certainly did, but we felt that they should may find their own way, and they have.
Dr. Lerner, your book ends in 1958. That's 42 years ago, a significant portion of your life, the academic portion, accrued since. Why did you choose to end it then?
Well, because I wanted to tell the story of what went before my successful part of my life started. Because this part of my life that I spent as an academic, you know, is widely available. Everybody can get it on the internet or wherever they want or by reading my books. And it's well known. And I felt that the other part of my life was not at all known. And so I wanted to show that. And I also, it was very important to me to show that I had gone through many decades of struggling with failure of various sorts or with difficulties and obstacles that I had to overcome. When my husband was blacklisted, we had to move. We moved back to New York and we had to start all over again. Economically totally insecure, and he happened to have made a very brilliant career as a film editor afterwards, but again, we didn't know that. But what happened to me was that my second novel could not find a publisher.
As a result of him being blacklisted, do you think?
No, it had to do with this housing integration, with the subject of racial integration, for which there was no interest in 58. Now, 3 years later, there was a lively interest in it, but I didn't know. I couldn't know that, right? And so I felt really blocked at every route, and so I decided my children were growing up, and my daughter was entering college, and my son was in high school, so I decided I would take a few courses so that I could write a different kind of writing. I thought maybe novel writing was not the way I was going to make a career as a writer, and I was going to write a historical novel. And I wrote started a historical novel on the Grimke sisters from South Carolina, who were the only white women from the South who became active abolitionists. And then I found that I needed to learn more about history to do this, and so I began to take a few courses in history. And that led very quickly to my taking an undergraduate degree. And it took me 4 years of part-time study to get an undergraduate degree. And then I went on to graduate study, and I had a historical biography of the Grimke sisters was my dissertation. And I managed to earn an MA and a PhD in 3 years after that. And that began my academic career.
Well, Dr. Gerda Lerner, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, I'll recommend a book that takes us back to colonial America, and it reads like fiction. It's by Laurel Ulrich, A Midwife's Tale, and it's a very fine book.
Dr. Gerda Lerner, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Well, thank you for asking me. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Gerda Lerner is the author of Fireweed, a political autobiography. The book she recommends is A Midwife's Tale by Laura Ulrich. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. Here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.